From the Voice of America, this is Learning English Weekend. I'm Katie Weaver. It's Saturday, April 23rd. Today, we'll listen to another classic American story. We'll also explore another national park. But first, we remember Prince.
I guess I should know by the way you popped your car sideways at a wooden mast. It's the other kind of person that believes in making out once, love them and leave them fast. Guess I must be dumb. She had a pocket full of horses, children, and some of them used. But it was Saturday night. I guess that makes it all right. You see, what have I got to lose? And honey, I say, little red Corvette.
Music fans and professionals are mourning the loss of revolutionary performer Prince Roger Nelson, better known as Prince. The artist was found dead in his home near Minneapolis, Minnesota, Thursday. He was 57 years old. Prince was a highly skilled musician. He played many instruments, including guitar, piano, and drums. He wrote popular songs that crossed many musical borders. He had a powerful voice with a wide, high-to-low range. Prince's music brought together many musical styles, including jazz, rhythm and blues, rock and roll, funk, and disco. He had his own unmistakable sound. Prince had music in his blood. His father was a jazz musician, and his mother was a singer. He became a performer at a young age. His first album, For You, came out in 1978. Prince was 19 at the time. Prince was famous for more than just his music. He wore makeup and bright, sexy clothing, including pink furs, shiny purple brocade, and high boots. Sometimes he wore very little at all. Many of the performer's lyrics described or referred to sex. One song, Darling Nikki, came under special attack by a powerful critic, Tipper Gore. Tipper Gore was married at the time to then-Senator Al Gore. Tipper Gore helped lead a parents' movement to place parental advisory messages on albums that included offensive words or language about sex and drugs. She said that she decided to act after watching her young daughter listen to Darling Nikki. Another of Prince's best-known songs is the 1984 single, Purple Rain. The album of the same name sold 20 million copies. Purple Rain was also made into a movie starring Prince. He won an Academy Award for the movie's music.
Oh.
Prince was a 7-time Grammy Award winner. He was admitted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2004. The Hall of Fame said Prince rewrote the rule book, forging a synthesis of black funk and white rock that served as a blueprint for cutting-edge music in the 80s. Yet the performer also fought with his record company, Warner Brothers, over control of his music. He even temporarily changed his name to a symbol after a contract dispute. For a time, reporters called him the artist formerly known as Prince. He left the record company but returned several years ago. Prince sold more than 100 million albums around the world, with hit songs such as Little Red Corvette, 1999, and When Doves Cry. He also wrote hit music for other performers, including Sinead O'Connor's Nothing Compares to You and The Bangles' Manic Monday. Many celebrities have been remembering Prince on social media sites. Stevie Wonder praised him for bringing different cultures together in music. Katy Perry tweeted, "The world lost a lot of magic." Madonna called him a true visionary. President Barack Obama also honored the musician. He called the artist a creative icon. He said, "As one of the most gifted and prolific musicians of our time, Prince did it all." Doctors will examine Prince's body to try to learn the cause of death. Officials say police found the musician in his home after they received an emergency call. They tried to rescue him, but he died. Prince was hospitalized last week. His private airplane made an emergency landing in Illinois after concerts in Georgia. Some reports said he was suffering from the flu. Up next, Ashley Thompson and I head west.
This week on our National Parks journey, we travel to America's mountainous Pacific Northwest. We are exploring Mount Rainier National Park in Washington State. The mountain in Washington rises more than 4,300 meters above sea level. It is one of America's most glacier-filled peaks. Snow covers the top of the mountain year-round. Its glacial meltwater forms 6 major rivers. The Native Americans who lived in the Northwest called the Great Mountain Tacoma. One tribe said it was a monster that would eat people. Other old stories among Native Americans said the mountain could produce great amounts of fire.
In 1792, British explorer George Vancouver became the first European to see the mountain. He named it after a Navy friend, Captain Peter Rainier. Today, the people who live in the northwestern city of Seattle simply call it the Mountain. Mount Rainier is almost 100 kilometers outside of Seattle. Yet it can be seen from almost any place in the city. Mount Rainier is not just a mountain. It is a sleeping volcano. Steam and heat often rise from the very top of the mountain, causing some of the snow to melt. More than 25 thick glaciers cover part of the mountain. Mount Rainier has long been a popular place to visit. Many people go to enjoy the beautiful and peaceful forests that surround the mountain. Others try to climb to the top of the great mountain. Hazard Stevens and Philemon von Trump became the first people known to reach the top of Mount Rainier. They reached the top in August of 1870 after a 10-hour climb through the snow.
In 1890, a young school teacher became the first woman to reach the top of Mount Rainier. Her name was Fay Fuller. For many years after her successful climb, she wrote newspaper stories asking the federal government to make Mount Rainier a national park. Many people who visited the mountain also wanted its environment to be protected by the federal government. In March of 1899, President William McKinley signed a law that made Mount Rainier a national park. It was the fifth national park established in the United States. Today, about 10,000 people try to climb to the top of Mount Rainier every year. The mountain is extremely difficult to climb. The National Park Service says only about half of the climbers successfully reach the top. Snow and ice cover parts of the mountain year-round. Severe weather is possible at any time. Many people have died trying to climb Mount Rainier. Experienced mountain climbers often use it as a difficult test for people who want to climb extremely tall mountains around the world.
But you do not have to be an experienced mountain climber to enjoy Mount Rainier National Park. More than 1 million people visit the park each year. Many enjoy hiking along the hundreds of kilometers of paths. The paths lead through flat meadows filled with wildflowers and up through forests of large old trees. Other visitors drive around the park to experience its natural beauty. They often see black-tailed deer, elk, and mountain goats. The large park is almost 100,000 hectares. Many lakes, rivers, roads, hotels, and camping areas are within the park. Experts believe that Mount Rainier could become a much more active volcano sometime in the near future. They say the real problem is that they do not know exactly when that could happen.
Experts also agree that the great heat produced by a volcanic explosion would melt the rivers of ice that are part of the mountain. This melting could happen in a matter of minutes. The melting ice would then produce flowing rivers of mud and rock. That would put people who live in the southern part of Seattle and in the nearby city of Tacoma in danger. These experts carefully study the conditions at Mount Rainier. They hope to be able to warn people of any dangerous change. But for now, the Great Mountain provides a safe and enjoyable place to visit in America's beautiful Pacific Northwest. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
Now the special English program, American Stories. The Western American city of San Francisco, California, suffered a huge earthquake on April 18, 1906. More than 3,000 people are known to have died. The true number of dead will never be known. 250,000 people lost their homes. Just a few hours after the terrible earthquake, a magazine named Collier's sent a telegraph message to the famous American writer Jack London. They asked Mr. London to go to San Francisco and report about what he saw. He arrived in the city only a few hours after the earthquake. The report he wrote is called The Story of an Eyewitness. Here is Doug Johnson with the story.
Not in history has a modern city been so completely destroyed. San Francisco is gone. Nothing remains of it but memories and a few homes that were near the edge of the city. Its industrial area is gone. Its business area is gone. Its social and living areas are gone. The factories, great stores and newspaper buildings, hotels and the huge homes of the very rich are all gone. Within minutes of the earthquake, the fires began. Within an hour, a huge tower of smoke caused by the fires could be seen 100 miles away. And for 3 days and nights, this huge fire moved in the sky, reddening the sun, darkening the day, and filling the land with smoke. There was no opposing the flames. There was no organization, no communication. The earthquake had smashed all the modern inventions of a 20th century city. The streets were broken and filled with pieces of fallen walls. The telephone and telegraph systems were broken, and the great water pipes had burst. All inventions and safety plans of man had been destroyed by 30 seconds of movement by the earth. By Wednesday afternoon, only 12 hours after the earthquake, half the heart of the city was gone. I watched the huge fire. It was very calm. There was no wind. Yet, from every side, wind was pouring in upon the city. East, west, north, and south, strong winds were blowing upon the dying city. The heated air made a huge wind that pulled air into the fire, rising into the atmosphere. Day and night, the calm continued, and yet, near the flames, the wind was often as strong as a storm.
There was no water to fight the fire. Firefighters decided to use explosives to destroy buildings in its path. They hoped this would create a block to slow or stop the fire. Building after building was destroyed. and still the great fires continued. Jack London told how people tried to save some of their possessions from the fire.
Wednesday night, the whole city crashed and roared into ruin, yet the city was quiet. There were no crowds. There was no shouting and yelling. There was no disorder. I passed Wednesday night in the path of the fire. In all those terrible hours, I saw not one woman who cried, not one man who was excited, not one person who caused trouble. Throughout the night, tens of thousands of homeless ones fled the fire. Some were wrapped in blankets. Others carried bedding and dear household treasures. Many of the poor left their homes with everything they could carry. Many of their loads were extremely heavy. Throughout the night, they dropped items they could no longer hold. They left on the street clothing and treasures they had carried for miles. Many carried large boxes called trunks. They held on to these the longest. It was a hard night, and the hills of San Francisco are steep, and up these hills, mile after mile, were the trunks dragged. Many a strong man broke his heart that night. Before the march of the fire were soldiers. Their job was to keep the people moving away from the fire. The extremely tired people would arise and struggle up the steep hills, pausing from weakness every 5 or 10 feet. Often, after reaching the top of a heartbreaking hill, they would find the fire was moving at them from a different direction. After working hour after hour through the night to save part of their lives, thousands were forced to leave their trunks and flee. At night, I walked down through the very heart of the city. I walked through mile after mile of beautiful buildings. Here was no fire. All was in perfect order. The police patrolled the streets, and yet it was all doomed, all of it. There was no water. The explosives were almost used up, and two huge fires were coming toward this part of the city from different directions. 4 hours later, I walked through this same part of the city. Everything still stood as before, and yet there was a change. A rain of ashes was falling. The police had been withdrawn. There were no firemen, no fire engines, and no men using explosives. I stood at the corner of Kearney and Market Streets in the very heart of San Francisco. Nothing could be done. Nothing could be saved. The surrender was complete. It was impossible to guess where the fire would move next. In the early evening, I passed through Union Square. It was packed with refugees. Thousands of them had gone to bed on the grass. Government tents had been set up. Food was being cooked, and the refugees were lining up for free meals. Late that night, I passed Union Square again. Three sides of the square were in flames. The square with mountains of trunks was deserted. The troops, refugees, and all had retreated. The next morning, I sat in front of a home on San Francisco's famous Nob Hill. With me sat Japanese, Italians, Chinese, and Negroes. All about were the huge homes of the very rich. To the east and south of us were advancing two huge walls of fire. I went inside one house and talked to the owner. He smiled and said the earthquake had destroyed everything he owned. All he had left was his beautiful house. He looked at me and said, "The fire will be here in 15 minutes." Outside the house, the troops were falling back and forcing the refugees ahead of them. From every side came the roaring of flames, the crashing of walls, and the sound of explosives. Day was trying to dawn through the heavy smoke. A sickly light was creeping over the face of things. When the sun broke through the smoke, it was blood red and small. The smoke changed color from red to rose to purple. I walked past the broken dome of the City Hall building. This part of the city was already a waste of smoking ruins. Here and there through the smoke came a few men and women. It was like the meeting of a few survivors the day after the world ended.
The huge fires continued to burn on. Nothing could stop them. Mr. London walked from place to place in the city, watching the huge fires destroy the city. Nothing could be done to halt the firestorm. In the end, the fire went out by itself because there was nothing left to burn. Jack London finishes his story.
All day Thursday and all Thursday night, all day Friday and Friday night, the flames raged on. Friday night saw the huge fires finally conquered, but not before the fires had swept 3/4 of a mile of docks and storehouses on the waterfront. San Francisco at the present time is like the center of a volcano. Around this volcano are tens of thousands of refugees. All the surrounding cities and towns are jammed with the homeless ones. The refugees were carried free by the railroads to any place they wish to go. It is said that more than 100,000 people have left the peninsula on which San Francisco stood. The government has control of the situation, and thanks to the immediate relief given by the whole United States, there is no lack of food. The bankers and businessmen have already begun making the necessary plans to rebuild this once beautiful city of San Francisco.
And that's Learning English Weekend for Saturday, April 23rd. Join us again tomorrow when Chris Cruz brings you the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend. I'm Katie Weaver.